Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, here for another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. If you're new to the channel, welcome. So glad to have you here with us. If you like what you end up seeing here, please hit like and subscribe on your way out. It's a passive gesture that goes a very long way. If you are a returning listener or subscriber, welcome back. So glad to have you here again with us. This should be a good show. We haven't done one of these in a long time. So very happy that Camila was here to join us. Also, here to do this with me, he is, you know, some people call him the king of Miami. We call him here the man of the Mau Mau Hour, the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
How are you? Are you ready? You know, I feel like the Caribbean is also involved here because, you know, the Dominican Republic is also having an election this year.
Absolutely.
Does that feel weird that that's counted as Latin America and it's just on the other side of the line?
Well, you know, some people consider Haiti part of Latin America as well because it's a French-speaking country in the which is a Latin language.
Well, how do you feel about that?
I think that there's logic to the argument. I wouldn't make that argument off the cuff. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of tortured history between Haiti and Latin America.
Well, 2024, as you know, marks an election year here in the U.S., but also in six other countries in the Americas as well. Two of the biggest countries, Brazil and Mexico. El Salvador, whose elections have already concluded, we'll get back to them. Panama, the Dominican Republic, Mexico, Brazil, Chile, and Uruguay all have big elections this year. Mexico, a country known for its culture of machismo, looks to possibly elect their first female president, Claudia Sheinbaum. If elected, will she continue the legacy of her predecessor, Manuel Lopez Obrador? Or will her Nobel Prize winning environmental science pedigree entice her to bring Mexico away from fossil fuels and closer to renewables? You know, AMLO actually approved a fossil fuel plant. Earlier this month, an election tribunal in Panama voted to annul the candidacy of former president Ricardo Martinelli. Martinelli served as president from 2009 to 2014, and last year was found guilty in a corruption scheme to use stolen public money to buy a stake in a publishing house. All that aside, Panama is one of the most corrupt and unequal countries in the world, dealing with a mounting environmental crisis. A famous canal, which fuels the country's economy, is running short of water. A vote to shut down a large copper mine caused Panama to lose 5% of its GDP. Panama is also home to a younger, maybe some say more revolutionary voting base. Will this be a bright light? Half of Panama's electorate is under 40, and they seem to want to bring an end to the country's legacy of corrupt politicians. But is the youth vote enough? That's just a few of the countries we'll get into with our good friend, TIR Latin correspondent, Camilo Gomez.
Yeah, always great to be back.
Good to have you back. Yes. I know you had some family stuff going on.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm glad everything's working out and sorry for your loss. And
yeah, thanks.
Good to have you back here.
Yeah, I think it is interesting now that I was thinking about how to start. I think sometimes, like, there are things that happen in Latin America don't get much mention, even if it had a kind of a global reach. For example, like, there has been this news that I don't think has been getting much coverage in the media in the Anglosphere, but it has some coverage in the Latin American media. That is that there are more news about, like, Colombian former soldiers now, like, being recruited to fight in for Ukraine. So
really?
Yeah, it probably shows that the number of soldiers of Ukraine is lower than they will want to. I think there were some that have tried to leave and maybe have been successful, like among the young men. So it seems very interesting that this doesn't get too much coverage, probably because the media, I think it didn't, for example, focus much on the news about, like, the Cuban soldiers, which also was kind of strange, and some argued that they were kind of not told exactly what they were going to do, and in that case it happened in the Russian case. So in the Ukrainian case, it seems that it was much more explicit. So the people were told, like, they were going to do, and this is the case of some professional soldiers. I have here that technically there are some Latin American volunteers, but there are not many kind of, you know, like, reports on the television, just, like, kind of were mentioned by a newspaper that one person decided to leave. But yeah, it is something that people are not putting much attention, despite that the Ukraine war has generated a lot of complexities in Latin America too, because, like, for example, Ecuador has a big banana industry, so they used to export a lot to Russia and have been having problems because obviously Russia has less currency availability. So that lack of funds made much more difficult the export. So it has generated complexities, like the grain. Ukrainian grain also was imported in Latin America. Also a bit of fertilizer. So the prices have been growing. So I think even if not, you know, directly, at least now, like, it is still affecting Latin America in a number of ways. But what I think it is most interesting is something we have talked a bit with you, that is that someone like Pedro Castillo was always mentioned in the American media for a while. And has gotten completely out of mention after his arrest and his attempt of a coup, but it has also get less press, kind of the more authoritarian, like, the repression that happened, like, in the protests that were calling for new elections, and the 50 people that died in those protests. The fact that also, like, the Peruvian Congress has approved a very radical change of the constitution that will include a Senate, and that Senate will have a lot of powers, that there is an attempt to remove the electoral authorities. And so what remains now is a kind of a corrupt alliance of different interests between, like, kind of the more reactionary forces and the more patriotic socialists, like the interior came with Pedro Castillo, and that alliance has been quite nefarious, and it has been very easy to support and connect, like, with the criminal organizations, both the formal ones, both the kind of more on the informal side of the economy, some companies that kind of are involved in different forms of exploitation in areas of the Amazon and illegal logging, illegal mining, and Yeah, it ends up being a lot of kind of confluence of different interests of kind of.
Let me ask you this, and I had this in as one of the first kind of questions. You know, you started off by saying that Pedro Castillo, and I think rightfully so, was kind of being heralded here in the West as a victory, because also he gets elected around the same time that there's still a lot of hope around Bernie Sanders here in the States. He gets in office, doesn't last long. As you say, he's not in prison yet, is he?
Yes, he is in prison, and I think it is kind of complex, like his figure, because well, it's true that in the beginning of the protest, some protesters reclaimed his release from prison and his reinstatement as president. Like, what is also true is that when the protests started getting repressed, it generates a larger confluence that generated that people that did not vote for Pedro Castillo either in the first round or in the second round started to go out to the streets. And this was a protest that was massive, particularly in much more in the regions rather than Lima, which it was much slow, the protest. And I think that there has been, I think in a way the kind of he became like very difficult to defend, and I not think that this is also like the best strategy to defend, but the disinterest that we see toward what is going in Peru is kind of complex, because still, like, I think what one could say about Peru, and I think probably there is still some people of all places, like, for example, the Council of Foreign Relations, which normally is not sympathetic to progressive politics per se, seems to be having a relatively positive view of the protest, in the sense, like, I think from some strategic vision, they also think that this kind of reactionary patriotic socialist pack is going to be much more pro-China in a way, because kind of anti-wokeism coalition. But also, I think it has to be that that some of the people that you know, because this kind of organizations that are a bit larger are able to put some people on the ground. I think even the New York Times and the Washington Post, which in some days have, like, particularly lately, having much more reactionary positions on other topics, have tried to be at least a bit more honest about, like, what is going on, because a great part of the mainstream media has basically purged any kind of critical vision, and the mainstream media in Peru has much more of a conservative leaning, which has a constriction in its coverage. So, for example, when it was revealed, like, the current president Dina Boluarte had a collection of Rolex watches, like, the amounts were thousands of dollars, it was revealed by independent media, like, and this has been one of the largest news in the last days. I mean, it has been covered in publications around, like, the U.S. and Europe that were kind of, like, forgetting Peru, but because of this news, like, kind of got in the news. I think even publications in Dutch and Japanese have covered. So yeah, it's kind of wild.
Would you call Dina Boluarte a Marxist-Leninist? She comes from the Marxist-Leninist Party. Or is that just where she's at?
I think it is curious. Like, I think I used to think, like, her relationship with the left was much more frail. At this point, I think, like, his brother is his relationship with the left. I think his brother is a very curious character that seems to be much more linked to the left, but that in the last years was having a much more pragmatic turn and kind of maybe ditching a bit of his original position, more pragmatic, but has maintained some sort of populist rhetoric, and he seems to try to inscribe his own party. So Dina Boluarte seems much more of a reformist, but he was either not particularly woke or anything, just that maybe she was seen as less extremist in her rhetoric as Pedro Castillo, although, as I think I have mentioned before, and I think even when talking with C. Eric Barron, I was telling him that Pedro Castillo for a moment sounded almost libertarian in some issues, but despite that, in that sense, she sounded much more moderate, and she was much more moderate in the way she approached the debates and in the political campaign in the first round. But he was, but she was kind of much more moderate in theory. But what he has seen is like basically an alliance. With the kind of like the corrupt of the pack of the corrupt, like the groups of power and with the, I think this question is interesting. Why does Pedro Castillo was described as a progressive populist? I think it has to do like that the rival was Keiko Fujimori, and that, you know, like Castillo was more pro-vax, I guess, like was more pro increasing the social safety net, and was at least in rhetoric pro-union. So I think in that sense, I think he had some of the elements of that rhetoric, but it was not as strong as some would have expected.
I wanted to ask you a question about Dina Boluarte. I remember when she was running, she ran on a very kind of like anti-native, almost kind of like Christian nationalist rhetoric as well. How was it you're saying that she was progressive when I noticed particularly that she was trying to almost act as if she was a reaction to the embrace of the indigenous nature of Peruvian people coming out of Pedro Castillo?
Yeah, I think the curious thing is that like she was her vice presidential candidate, and she speaks in Quechua, and that sometimes when she's criticized, she denounced racism. So I think in a way, like what you mentioned is correct. I think she was much more moderate in a way, in some sense also more reactionary, like maybe moderate, like not. I think the relationship of the left, I think, like what someone has mentioned, like what the relationship with Shining Path and the Emirate, yeah. I think that is a complicated story, because like the Shining Path and the Emirate attacked like the organized left. So literally like some part of the organized left died in the years of the internal conflict. So the reorganization of what it was remaining of that left like was very weakened and kind of even regionalized, because like very different regions have kind of in a way different tendencies. Like you have in the region, for example, from where Pedro Castillo is, you still had some sort of forms of cooperativism, like kind of like agrarian cooperatives, like that have maybe that probably explains why his rhetoric is a bit more pro-market in an strange way, because like obviously cooperatives try to compete in the market and try to sell stuff within the market. While in other areas, like much more rural, like kind of like the production was much more communitarian, so like on a communal basis and kind of like of self-subsistence. So I think like a lot of those the diversity of the of the expressions within the Peruvian left were never kind of consolidated within one party. And that was even when in the 80s, like Peru had a larger left than Brazil, like in number of parties and percentage per capita of the population involved in left-wing politics. So it is curious because now, like, a lot of the, even the critics of the left now, they come from the left, which is kind of strange. I think that in a way, Dina Boluarte is the face of a conservative reaction against Pedro Castillo. And as you mentioned, kind of the attempt of Peru to return to its indigenous roots. But also, I think it's kind of, particularly lately, I think the press that to some degree was sympathetic in because they were much more right-leaning with the ousting of Pedro Castillo, have been much more critical lately because I think she's still not as far right enough for them. And I think that the constraints that there are, because the election is going to be in 2026, so in 2 years, like there is going to be a very convoluted scene because there are a lot of parties and there is going to be much more fraction about, like, so probably the two candidates that are going to pass to the second round are going to have less than 20%, so like the representativity is going to be very low.
Pascal.
So how does this affect overall Latin American and South American politics? Well, you have a left that's not really grounded in any kind of actual organized functioning unless it really can mobilize from the extreme when there's so much infighting. Even though many people say that South America and Latin America are the most successful examples we've seen of left organizing in the aughts with the Pink Flag.
I think it's interesting because I think that the something that is not much mentioned, but is the trade union movement, which was very prosecuted in the times of terrorism because it was tried to be related to like they were trying to found like relationships, although it's very different because like the for good and for bad, like the trade union movement, like in Peru, had a lot of influence from the Stalinists, like the Communist Party, and obviously like the Maoists of Chanimpad and the Guevarists of the MRTA were not too sympathetic to the trade unions because of that, and the teacher trade unions were in the past under the control of another Maoist party, which was Red Farland, but they did believe in elections, so they were opposed also to Shane. But because, you know, the reality was that those parties were seen as part of the left, so there was kind of a backlash against trade unions. But what we have seen in the last years, I think, since the pandemic, is that kind of there is a bit of reorganization of that trade union movement, in not completely unionized in a under a big banner of one trade union, but in under different banners. But that's is interesting. Also, something interesting is like this Women's Day. It was the largest Women's Day protest in Lima, which is the capital of Peru. So it has been important that the feminist movement, and to be honest, the LGBTQ movement also are kind of converging, because part of the feminist movement had always kind of this divide between like kind of the more white feminists well off and kind of more of the more indigenous and feminists, which tended to be much more left wing. And in the case of the LGBTQ movement, it had some, in a weird way, much. It is curious because like other LGBTQ movement was started by leftists, but at the same time, it also had some expressions, political expressions that were much more conservative. So there was a gay discotheque that was owned by a conservative, and there is a gay mayor that is also conservative. So you did have, until recently, and even now, you have some gay conservatives, but now I think the organized LGBTQ movement is moving toward the left, because they see now, like the business conservatives, I guess they were more neutral on LGBTQ stuff, but always like the much more common expression of conservatism now in Peru, the far right is obviously much more against them. So in that sense, I also think that has been kind of a reaction of everything that's happening. You're starting to see a radicalization of minorities and a radicalization of workers.
Mm. Switching up gears a little bit, Mexico is looking at a massive election, not just the possible election of the country's first female president, but there are tens of thousands of local and federal positions up for grabs. Do you think Claudia Sheinbaum wins? If so, will she ruffle the feathers in the West if she attempts to move away from fossil fuels? Or do you see her as a continuation of AMLO? And then what do you think AMLO's legacy is going to be as a president of Mexico?
I think it's interesting because to start with AMLO, I think generally, like the Latin America press generally, when talking of AMLO, it generally focuses on something that gets forgotten and outside of Latin America, that in a way he has continued a lot of policies that were previous, kind of on free trade, on kind of like economic integration with the United States, and also to some degree to the war. So in that sense, I don't think there is going to be a very like big shift. I think that there is some sense that Sheinbaum is more progressive, mm-hmm. on social issues, and but I think also for some reason, like at least she has been linked to the TERFs. Like this is kind of a trans
exclusionary radical. They linked her to the TERFs, you said?
Yeah, so some of her links are kind of strange for, mm-hmm. So I think that it's interesting because now there is also going to be an election in Uruguay. For example, I see, for example, a Uruguayan left taking a much more staunch social liberal approach, but basically because Uruguay is very secular. I don't think in Mexico you were going to be as staunch social liberal turn. About its economics, I think it's going to be very very complex to predict, because I don't think there is going to be that much radical change. But at the same time, I do feel the discourse with AMLO was very different than in the past, and that was kind of strange because as you might have noticed, like the American expat community in Latin America has grown a lot, and, yeah. And they are all over the political spectrum, but even the more right ones somehow are sympathetic to AMLO because they see the kind of is embracing an agenda of economic growth and the, you know, like and for example, some of them, which are is curious, maybe could introduce another subject, are not very even the right-wing expats are not very hopeful on Milei. They actually think he's going to fail.
I haven't heard very good things in the little bit of conversation I've heard politically around here. You know, kind of back to the point about AMLO, there's one thing that he's kind of loud about, and that's, you know, almost that making people pay their fair share. And as you know, a person that lives in Latin America, when American companies come in, they don't pay taxes, they don't pay anything. And every so often, someone in office shakes the apple cart up and forces these people to pay up. And I know AMLO did that walking in the door with, I want to say it was Starbucks and another company. but I haven't seen a Pemex gas station here. I've seen a Chevron, you know, I've seen Arco, you know, there's a Walmart in town now. So, he's definitely friendly with American business. What's funny is, I think I said this on the show before, the U.S. radio towers are by my house. I can like walk to them. So they broadcast some things in Spanish and most of it in English. And one of the things they do is a commercial where they remind people that maybe, you know, expats driving back and forth, that AMLO is a friend to American business.
I mean, the most weird part about like kind of the American expat communities is that for some reason, like Uruguay actually has a growing expat community, but for a very simple reason, like they have an 11-year tax rebate to above certain income. So there are a lot of retirees and people that are actually quite well off that move to Uruguay, which is kind of curious. And many of them are actually libertarian, which is kind of strange in a country that is the most left-wing country in Latin America. But yeah, it has grown, certainly, like the American expat community. And I don't know what's going to be its impact on the elections. In some areas, like when it's just tourism, it maybe has generated like much more growth than expected. But you know, it's going to be. I mean, it depends. It varies from place to place. Like there are places where people stay 1 month. Where there are places where people are moving. Ecuador used to be that place, because of the state of emergency, their security kind of problems that they have, like a lot of them are leaving, not all to other parts of Latin America, but yeah, it also show how like not always permanent things are. And I think, yeah, it's going to be interesting to watch, this year electorally. I think it's interesting because like, as you mentioned, in Chile, like there is also elections and a lot of people are predicting that the left is going to be weakened, because despite it having given some prerogatives on the economic side of the issue, I think they are losing a bit of the dialogue in terms of security and in terms of immigration. So
are they getting hit? I'm sorry to interrupt you. Is Chile getting hit with refugees from Venezuela as well?
Yes.
Really? Are they getting hit with Haitians too, or just Venezuelans?
Haitians too. Like, and it's much more complex because they also have much more economic immigrants from Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia. So not just refugees properly, like, but yeah, it is. It has been a place of strong immigration historically. Although it has, by the way, like for example, like American expats used to go to Chile, like almost no goes now, like for some. Now like the immigration to Mexico is mostly from neighboring countries, to some degree from Haiti. There are some Dominicans too, as far as I'm aware, but yeah, it's mostly from South Americans and Haitians and Dominicans. So that's what is going on lately. I think the reception have been very different. I think that the most conflict has been with Venezuelans, particularly because of the link of the Tren de Aragua, which is this kind of criminal network that is Venezuelan.
So that is that the story that the news is reporting, that there's a criminal element from Venezuela coming up through Chile?
Yes, I think that has been kind of the framing. I will say that the, in a way, like Chile is having a security like issue in the sense like the that it was considered also one of the safest countries in Latin America. Mm-hmm. So now it's not as safe, but it still is not, you know, at levels of that El Salvador was until recently, or Honduras for what the matter now. Although I think it has decreased a bit, but it has seen. The perception of insecurity is probably like what Germany is kind of a much more a public perception that is changing. And I think also there is, from an anthropological way, Chile sees itself as unique in a way, as try to be isolated from Latin America. And in that sense, I think it is kind of strange for them to see like a very increase in immigration. And I think it is a bit of change that has kind of put in a difficult position, Chilean politicians and on the left. Also some corruption scandals, not as big as in other countries, but still have tainted like part of the left politics in Chile. So those elements are still kind of giving a lot of nightmares to left-wing politicians. In Brazil, something interesting that has happened was like the detention of police officers related to the death of Maria.
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, and I think this probably shows that kind of like how deep the racism, sexism, and homophobia of the Brazilian police was. There is, I think, a scholar that used to taught in a political scientist. I'm forgetting her name, but she wrote a book about. She's an American political scientist. She wrote a book about policing in Latin America, and she was mentioned, for example, in Bolivia and comparing to Brazil. And she was saying that in Bolivia, like, you know, sometimes the police like go after like kind of like street sellers, things like that. But you know, it was not something nice to watch. But you know, like they were saying like, oh, go out of here, like you shouldn't sell here. But when she saw that in Brazil, it was just like some giant kind of combat riot, attacking a grandmother, like something like that, which, you know, like she was so like that was really extreme. So I think that in a way, the Brazilian police was perceived to be as much more violent, but also in a way much more willing to engage in combat. Like, because as I mentioned, in some parts of Latin America, I think there is a perception that the police against the real criminals is not willing to fight. But in the case of the Brazil, like they are very fond of using weapons, so that's not their quarrel with them. Like their quarrel is like the abuse of their use of weapons. Like sometimes they just start to shoot like in an area like it has a lot of civilians. So it is like kind of the armed restraint and the relation between kind of the army and the police and with the far right politics, which also like kind of led to Bolsonaro and now like some argue we are seeing the political end of Bolsonaro, but not the end of Bolsonarismo, because Bolsonarismo evolved. Like Bolsonaro himself was kind of a national conservative in some way, like kind of a big gourmet conservative, but reactionary.
Yes.
And then to get elected, he tried to reach some sort of libertarian rhetoric, but then when he was elected, like he tried to do a lot of populism, which was curious because like the Brazilian libertarians of all people, like, were the ones that started criticizing him, and actually, I think they left his coalition.
Well, I mean, he wanted a return to the dictatorship. We have to be honest. He really dug that dictatorship. He came up in the dictatorship, if I'm not mistaken. Didn't he?
Came out of the military.
Yeah, during the dictatorship, right?
Yep.
Yeah. We have a question, a super chat question from TIR member Dizzle McFizzle. What is Latin America's opinion on the host? Also, is it true what Big Daddy Kane said that pimping ain't easy? Explain. Pascal, do you want to take this one?
I don't think Latin America has an opinion on the host. I don't think Dizzle McShizzle has a question that he's trying to elicit.
Is pimping easy, Pascal?
Depending on where you are, pimping may be easier than in other places.
I don't know. Technically, I live in Latin America. Technically, I would say it's a very tough job, and I will plead the fifth on the host. All that being said, back to more serious things. Venezuela has a situation with Guyana. Have you been following any of that, Pascal?
Yes, I have been following the situation with Venezuela and the Guyanese situation. A border dispute in which Venezuela was basically trying to claim Guyanese territory. Resolved in peace, from what I understand, for now, between the two countries. But kind of scary to see who do you side with when you have a left ally who was engaging in what you believe is basically imperialism-light policy.
How do you look at that, Camilo? Do you look at that as imperialism-light, what's going on with Venezuela and Guyana? And do you think we look at Venezuela as almost a magical left country when it might not be as left as we think?
I think it is interesting because you will think it will get more coverage in Latin America, but it hasn't get much coverage like the conflict between Venezuela and Guyana. And I think it is interesting in the sense, like, if one looks at Venezuela now, I think like there is a lot of difference with Venezuela in the beginning, because now it even criticizes the left-wing governments. But in the beginning, like, the goal of Chavez was try to promote a kind of a Bolivarian, so in the sense, like, kind of hemispheric socialism and try to promote socialism in different countries. And in that sense, like, he was a transforming figure, like, in a controversial way and certainly eccentric way. But I mean, it has been, I think there are a lot of criticisms that were, you know, his human rights records, obviously his management of the economy. But I think even some independent observers have mentioned, like, the main reason of the problems of Venezuela, like, on the economic sphere, has been, like, the sanctions of the United States. Yeah. Because being an oil-dependent country, like, those were very easy to hurt.
That was brutal.
Yeah. And that is kind of, like, the problem. Like, there was a promise to lift part of the sanctions if they allow, like, opposition candidates to participate, and now the access of the presidential candidates from the opposition seems that is not going to happen. So that is going to generate more protests likely. It's not clear what the United States will do, because it had removed some sanctions, and some argue that to some degree, like, there was seen some sort of liberalization in the sense, like, the dollar is used as de facto currency. But still, it's not clear. I think that that now, in a way, like the leader of the Latin American left is much more Lula, in the sense that he had a much more clear kind of internationalist vision, although he also has been relatively silent on Peru. And as far as I am aware, like the pressure to say something on Peru has been coming from the further left, so the PSOL, which is a kind of much more left wing party than the Workers Party.
He's been silent on Peru. He's been silent on Haiti. He's been silent on a whole bunch of things.
Yeah.
I mean, why do you think that is? Do you think his time in jail hardened him in a certain way?
Yeah, although, as far as I know, and Pascal will say it better, from what I understood, he was sympathetic to sending the UN forces to Haiti. So that was kind of controversial, but now he kind of has backed down. Like, it sounds a bit weird, his declarations toward Haiti, but on other issues, like, he seems much more outspoken on Palestine, on a lot of international issues. I think he comes from the trade union movement in an era where the trade union movement was much more militant, because now you even have some reactionary unions. But I think he has spoken on most issues surrounded Latin America. Now he's much more conflictive with regards to Venezuela, although not as much as in the past. Even Petro has said some things against Maduro, which I don't think you will have seen that some years ago. But I think, in a way, the crisis of the also Bolivia, like without Evo Morales, like kind of the internal conflict within the MAS, like they have expelled the president from the MAS, which is kind of weird. I think now, like, Lula has kind of like it's in his peak of influence, but at the same time, I think that in a way, the politics are becoming much more local, despite the kind of globalization. And in that sense, you know, like, you see the emergence of Pedro Castillo was kind of out of the blue, like the Bureau, like, it seems out of nothing. And in a way, he, in a big way, represents some sort of the alternative lefts and this kind of lefts that sometimes are forgotten. In the case of Argentina, for example, like, the Peronists are divided, because some Peronists, like the more right-wing Peronists, are kind of supporting Milei, for example. So the relationship with the left and Peronists have been quite complex. But now, like, it has been kind of challenged, and a lot of the Latin American left also don't see the Chilean left much. With much sympathy, like, it seems that despite its attempts to be progressive to some degree, it's trying to appease too much the U.S. on a lot of issues.
Well, and I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's basically it. So in that sense, I think Lula has reached kind of the peak of the influence within the Latin American left.
Pascal, do you want to add something?
Do you think the Latin American left has reached the peak of its influence in Latin America?
I think it is interesting because, there was, like, in the 80s, I think, like, Hugo Blanco was considered to be, like, the, which is a Trotskyist politician, but he was very popular because he led some peasant rebels. Mm-hmm. And he was going to be a presidential candidate, but because in the coalition there were some Stalinists, like the Foreign International, say that he could not be the candidate. So, you know, like, I think at that point they were allied to the Foreign International, was based on Brussels. So it was really weird. But in a way, I think that yes, as strange as it sounds, like sometimes like when the old parties, like the communist parties or the Trotskyist parties, even the Maoist parties, like were much more aligned to forces outside of it. So so now like that all of this institutions have kind of crumbled, even like the Trotskyists in Latin America come from now from their own kind of Latin American versions of Trotskyism. So they are much more in a way independent of the foreign left, which I think it's kind of complex, because I also think that issues like, for example, like the recognition of the Sahrawi Republic, that used to be a very strong case in the left. Also, the issue of Palestine does remain to be kind of a symbol of alliance, and you do see not only have been protests in all countries of Latin America, which are rare that some international cause generate protests in all countries of Latin America. But also you see the flag of Palestine in trade union protests and in basically in any left-wing event. So I think in that sense, there are some elements that still try to reach the Latin American solidarity. So that still is out there.
I mean, what do you think about this current iteration of Lula, Pascal?
I'm not impressed at all, Jason. I'll be very honest with you, man. I think he's too conservative, and he thinks he's overly precautious. He strikes me as he's much more willing to make concessions to the centrist functionaries of his government and the kind of NATO kind of, you know. I mean, he's stuck in a conundrum. Let's be really honest. His cabinet is typical with right wingers, as somebody adequately noted in the chat. But at the same time, we still have this kind of like duopoly of the Trump neo crypto fascist global order versus the NATO alliance, and whose side are you on? And he's got to play between those two sides. Mm-hmm. So. I mean, to be fair, to be more fair, he's in a rough situation. But I think I've made it clear to you, man. I just think that the left really just gave up its opportunity because of Trumpism. We really, really, really cowered at the ability to distinguish ourselves from liberalism and neoliberalism and engaged in a kind of tacit popular front with the neoliberals out of a desire to fight against Trump because we didn't want to get blamed for Trumpism.
Well, let me ask both of you guys this question. Trump doesn't arrive in a vacuum, and he arrives at a time when there's a bit of a shift globally to some, I think we can agree, far right leaders, right? Duterte in the Philippines comes on around the same time. Bolsonaro a few years later but he comes on the heels of I can't think of his name, Michel Temer, who had took over after the ouster of Dilma Rousseff, who had just kind of dismantled a lot of the things that the Workers' Party had done in Brazil. You have Brexit at the same time as Trump. Who am I forgetting? Didn't Orban get reelected?
Orban, you have Bologna in Italy.
You had the rise of a kind of a more fascistic, or what people were calling a fascistic right in France. And people kind of get behind Macron. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just adding some global context onto the Trump phenomenon, because I don't think he comes in by himself like he would like to think. There's a lot of more right forces, I think, at play globally at the same time. And that's just a handful of countries. That's the name off the top of my head. If we sat down here and thought about it, there'd probably be a lot more that we could
come up with. Trump is actually the late iteration of an early phenomenon.
that phenomenon is real, what do you think the better strategy would have been?
I don't think the left in America and in the West should have embraced holding hands with neoliberals and liberals to fight those right wingers.
That's fair. I cannot. Let's go ahead, Camille.
Yeah, I think it is interesting now, like the polls show that Trump is making inroads with the Latin Americans in the U.S.
Yes.
So I think it is a very kind of strange his trying frame as an anti-globalist and, you know, and kind of at the same time like in defense of businesses, which is kind of a weird position that he has taken, but it seems that kind of has had some sense of anti-establishment, and I think that in a way what allow, for example, in Peru, Pedro Castillo to win was seen as anti-establishment. So
yeah,
the candidates that are seen as completely against the system are able to I think it's interesting this reflection about popular frontism. I think it's interesting, like the case of Argentina, for example, like with Peronism, you had a very broad coalition of different forces, like they include, you know, very reactionary forces to, you know, like even communists, like, but they lost an election. I think it is an example, like, that there is a kind of people are tired of the same politics again and again, and in a way the kind of emergence of Trump-like figures are going to are a phenomenon that is kind of like the rebellion against the perceived elites and which sometimes are part of the elite and sometimes are not, and I think it is kind of complex, like the projects of that could be developed, like toward you know, escaping kind of this liberal neoliberal framework in a sense, you know, like the in very different ways, like both in the US in a presidential system and in Europe in the parliamentary systems, like that convergence have happened. I do think that what became clear lately is that there are frictions not only outside of the attempts of popular frontism, but even against the ones that are against popular frontism and what should replace it. I mean, the whole thing with Cornel West and whatever comes of the attempts of the People's Party and things like that is kind of curious to see. But I think there are... you know, someone mentioned Scorbing. I think it's interesting because I think maybe politicians that are seen as much more outer could still win. And I think that we have seen in Latin America many times. Although in one could say that to some degree those parties have tried to adapt also to more that liberal, neoliberal kind of rhetorics to some practices, but yeah, I think it is true that there needs to be some sort of disruption within the left to be able to shift to our directions.
Well, in this big time election year, do you see any big shifts in these six countries that are having major elections? Or does it seem a lot more as business as usual for you?
I think it's going to be interesting. The one in Uruguay, even if it's generally a country that people speak the less, Because in Uruguay, you have like the Frente Amplio, which is a large coalition of left-wing parties. So although some are much more social democratic or are, you know, like Trotsky's or, you know, communists, but I think generally they have been much more outspoken about like things that happen in within the region. So I hope they're going to say some things about Peru and other countries that, that are not getting too much interest in the international media. I think it was important, like what Jose Mujica did in the 2000s, even like in the second round, he endorsed Pedro Castillo. I think it's going to be interesting because like the Uruguayan left has also a very curious relationship with the Peruvian left. Like many, when the dictatorship and the military dictatorship came in 1973, like many exile in Peru. So yeah, it's a very curious relationship, the one that the Uruguay and Peru have. In the, but I don't think there is going to be a shift that radical in a way in the region overall. I do feel that that despite the possibilities of changing political parties, I think that in the situation of kind of like economic spiral after the pandemic, you know, uncertainty, I don't think there is going to be that much radical economic change that is going to happen. Like the only country where things seem to be changing is Argentina, but you know, for the worse. And I don't.
Well, El Salvador, do you think El Salvador? Well, I guess it's a re-election for their president.
Yeah, I think the what we have seen in El Salvador, like it's the, I mean, it's the a military basically like arresting a larger amount of people. Like it's going to decrease crime, but it also has made the country much more unstable in a way, like that the Salvadorians still leave the country. So I do feel in
these
some
crypto
way,
bros can't wait to move down there.
Yeah, it has generated a weird attraction of the crypto bros, but yeah, it is I think a challenge to certainly the challenge of security shows that, you know, like a president can run on security and win, and despite not having like much economic deliveries, like he can basically build a stronger base of support to win elections kind of strongly.
I mean, my fear about Bukele is that this rhetoric, because I heard it on the right wing radio as I was driving down and then back up to the States to visit family, was that people were quoting his numbers on the death rates. Because, you know, I think El Salvador was like one of the most dangerous countries in the world. And he gets in office and just starts locking everybody up. And for a lot of people, that's still the solution. You know, to Pascal, to your point, to the neoliberals, it's lock you up a nicer way with an ankle bracelet that maybe you finance. Lock you up in a foster home. Like, we're going to find a way to lock you up. It's just not going to be as brutal as the next guy. But putting you away is kind of everybody's solution. And to see the numbers decrease as drastically as they've gone down from what's reported, let's also keep in mind what's reported, and police killings get reported differently for the murder rates as well. So, and but don't think police aren't killing people willy-nilly down there.
Well, I think something curious is that when I see, for example, news of the United States, of as strange as it seems, like it seems some politicians in blue states are trying to implement some Bukele policies.
Yeah.
Like the ones in Eric Adams, like now, like he's, yeah. So I think it is strange, like, but in a way, I was expecting some of that because, Bukele didn't run as a conservative. Like now, it has kind of adopted that rhetoric, but you know, he ran much more of a broadly defined populist, like much more vaguely. But I think the model of El Salvador is kind of it's interesting in a way for right wingers to try to copy. But as we have seen in Ecuador, like with the state of security, a lot of the mention of Bukele even by name is that the murder rates have lower, but the kidnapping rates have higher are higher. So that's that's part of the story. Like the security situation in El Salvador was basically two large gangs, and in Ecuador are 20 criminal gangs that have been described as terrorists by the Ecuadorian state. So it's much more easier to go after two large criminal gangs than 20 factionalized criminal gangs, and also some of those gangs are foreigners, so maybe they also are crossing the borders, and the Amazon particularly is like the borders are very almost non-existent, so they are not like it's very easy to escape, and that has shown like the limits of Bukelismo in Latin America, and that I think that those limits are going to be seen much more closely also in Argentina. Even like as weird as it sounds, like a lot of this basically put like men in underwear, like it's basically like the Bukelismo aesthetics have been copied in Argentina. But apparently, like the Minister of Security of Salvador sent a memorandum to Argentina and said that only when the security situation is solved you can do that, because like when if you take a picture of someone in their underpants, like probably the lawyer or some of their criminal associates like that haven't been detained, like are also taking the assets or evidence and try to want to play against you. So in a way, their attempt of copying the aesthetics, but without any strategy, is going to be worse, and because it's kind of alerting criminal organizations to try to move more underground rather than disappear.
That's a good point. Well, we are coming up on the end of the hour, and we'll be going into the champagne room, where we'll be joined by M. Toussaint, where Pascal wants to take a deep dive into maybe the trial of the century, the raid of Sean Puffy Combs' house.
Send me the link via email, buddy.
And Pascal also wants to talk about Kanye West changing his name.
Please send me the link via
email. I will. Are you going to hang out with us, Camila, or you got to go?
Yes, yeah, I have time. No problem.
Okay, I will send you the link then as well. Thank you guys for joining us. If you're a new person watching the show, if you enjoyed what you saw, please hit like, please hit subscribe. Don't forget to hit that notification bell. If you want to join us in the champagne room, where I'm not joking, Pascal is going to have a deep dive discussion on Sean Combs. Also, word on the street is Toussaint has the footage handy of Candace Owens on The Breakfast Club. Oh my goodness. It is going to be good times in the champagne room. If you want to become a patron, it's patreon.com/bitterlakepresents. For as little as $3 a month or $30 for the year, you can join us. If you're listening on Apple, if you just subscribe, you can hear all of the champagne-inspired shenanigans in the champagne room. Thank you, Camilo. If you guys have any comments, if there's something that you feel we left out. If there is something you want to add, make sure you leave it in the comments. We're all going to look at it, and I might yell at you about it later. We are out.